In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 399. Well, I have reached a major milestone. I have finally finished the work I'm going to be doing for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program. RonPaulHomeschool.com is the site, and I have done it. It turned out to be nearly 400 videos on Western civilization from antiquity to the 20th century, as well as 90 lessons on government. So put together just about 400 videos. This is for the high school grades. And it's pretty much everything I know. Like, I don't know anything else other than what's in those courses. That's pretty much it. Well, not quite, but it's the kind of thing where I thought to myself, what would have been useful for me to know when I was that age? Or what would have been unbelievable for me to know at that age? Or what would have saved me a lot of grief if I had known at that age? So particularly for my government course, what I tried to do was to take everything I know and distill it into these 90 videos, everything I've learned over the past 20 years, so that when these students get out of this program, they're going to have a huge head start. That was my plan. Well, the reason I am prefacing this episode with this bit of good news is that the topic for today seems completely random. If I'm going to cover a historical topic, usually I do so because it's some anniversary of that event. You know, it's 100 years since World War I broke out or something like that, which is what we did last year when we had World War I week on the show. But today it's a totally random topic just because, first of all, I want to try this out, see what you guys think of an episode in which I just cover a historical topic and talk about it, but also because it's fresh in my mind because I've been covering it recently in my Western Civilization from 1493 course for RonPaulHomeschool.com, and I want to give you guys kind of the Reader's Digest version. I think the Russian Revolution is one of the most interesting topics ever, basically in the whole history of the world. And in particular, I think V.I. Lenin, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, is one of the most interesting people. Doesn't make him a good guy, obviously, but he's certainly a very interesting person. So what I'm going to do is, in this episode, I'm going to talk about this subject. I'm going to talk about him in particular, and I'm going to give you the short version. I spent a whole week on this, so five full lessons, because it's 36 weeks, five lessons per week for these Ron Paul courses. It's a K-12 program, by the way. One of these days, I'll do an episode on how great it is and so on. But I'll give you the 20-minute version. And of course, in the 20-minute version, I'm leaving some things out. We're glossing over some things. But it is such an extraordinary episode, you can hardly believe that it actually happened. So I won't talk about the February Revolution of 1917. We'll start with the October Revolution and just talk about what happens over the next few years after that. In 1917, of course, there are two revolutions in Russian history. The first one is the one that overthrows the Tsar. It doesn't quite overthrow the Tsar, but he voluntarily abdicates in order to try to quell unrest and restore stability. And then later in the year, you get the communists, the Bolsheviks, overthrowing that government. So in other words, the Tsar is gone, replaced by something called the Provisional Government in the February Revolution, and then the Provisional Government is gone and replaced by the Bolsheviks, a strain of communists, in the October Revolution. Of course, there's a calendar difference in Russia in 1917 as compared to the calendar used in the West, and therefore what they call the February Revolution actually occurred in March for us, and what they call the October Revolution occurred in November for us. But I'll just use February and October because those are the usual historical terms. Well, anyway, Lenin is quite an extraordinary figure. His brother was executed for his role in plotting the assassination of Tsar Alexander II. And some people think this is what radicalized Lenin and made him interested in politics. But that's not true. Actually, at the time, he shows no interest in politics whatsoever. It's later on he gets expelled from university for demonstrating against various university regulations, and he could not get admitted anywhere else. He spends the next 4 years reading radical literature, Marxist literature, revolutionary literature, and this converts him to that cause. Eventually, he does get admitted to law school, but this converts him to that cause. Now, it's very revealing what an acquaintance of Lenin's had to say. He said, his principal disposition was hatred. Lenin took to Marx's doctrine precisely because it was so congenial to that principal disposition of his mind. The doctrine of class war, relentless and thoroughgoing, aiming at the final destruction and extermination of the enemy, proved congenial to Lenin's emotional attitude to surrounding reality. He hated not only the existing autocracy and the bureaucracy, not only lawlessness and arbitrary rule of the police, but also their antipodes, in other words, their exact opposites, the liberals and the bourgeoisie. That hatred had something repulsive and terrible in it. It was abstract and cold, like Lenin's whole being. And like Marx, Lenin spoke about collectives, about workers, about the bourgeoisie, but not so much about individuals. And in fact, we don't see a lot of, well, compassion for individuals. There was a famine on the Volga River around, if I'm recalling this right, around 1890 to 91, and Lenin actively discouraged his friends from assisting people in the famine. He thought the famine could play an important pedagogical role. It would teach people about the realities of non-socialist economies. Of course, it's socialist economies that give you the most famines, but that was not yet apparent to people just yet because we hadn't yet had the experiments, so-called, with socialism. Lenin writes an important little work in 1902 called What is to be Done, in which he lays out some ideas that are at variance with traditional Marxism. Karl Marx, of course, had laid out what he believed to be scientifically demonstrated laws of history, and that communism was where history was inevitably moving. History was inevitably moving toward communism. There would be class struggles in different stages of history. And those class struggles, out of them, would emerge a new kind of society with its own class struggles. And that struggle would yield you still another society until you finally you reach the penultimate, that is to say, the second to last stage of history, namely capitalism. And in capitalism, the class struggle becomes particularly terrible. And you have a situation in which the vast majority of the public belongs to the proletariat, the working class. And a very small sliver belongs to the we might call the owning class or the bourgeoisie, the people who own the means of production, the people who employ everybody else. And this everybody else becomes immiserated to the point at which it rises up. You get the culmination of this class struggle yields you socialism slash communism. And history comes to an end. There's nothing else propelling it because there are no classes to have struggles with each other in communist society. Communist society is the classless society, and therefore this yields you the end of history. Also, capitalism is bound to be replaced by socialism, according to Marx, because capitalism in its most mature phase very obviously becomes what he calls fetters on the productive forces. Now, some people have had trouble understanding what he means by that. It looks like what he means by that is that he believes that the boom-bust cycle is inherent to capitalism, that, you know, the economy is doing well, then it's doing badly, then it's doing well, then it's doing badly. That's just the way capitalism is, says Lenin, and indeed said Marx as well. And even some free market economists believe that. Of course, as Austrians, we believe there's another explanation for the boom-bust. On the show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/399, I will link to the episode we did on the boom-bust cycle, the Austrian theory of the business cycle. But anyway, so he believes that capitalism becomes fetters on the productive forces. What that means is that when you're going through a recession or a depression, you notice there are a lot of resources that aren't being used. It's like the idle resources point that Keynes made. You've got all these laborers who are just standing around doing nothing. So all the things they could have been doing have now gone to waste. You got all these factories that are sitting there idle. Well, what about all the things they could have been producing? That's all going to waste. Capitalism, because of capitalism, all these things go to waste. But under socialism, because you'll have scientific central planning, you won't have all this waste. So socialism won't be fetters on the productive forces. So in other words, all these reasons yield you the coming of communism, and it's totally inevitable. Now, Lenin is going to dissent from this a bit in the following ways. First, he does not seem to be as sanguine as Marx is that communism is going to come inevitably. It's coming inevitably, says Marx. The workers will rise up and establish it. But Lenin believed that the workers would not do any such thing, that the workers left to their own devices are not going to have enough of an insight into the big picture to do such a thing. They're going to be content to just improve their status in the existing system. Maybe they'll join a labor union, for example, and then they'll think they're really cheeky, sticking it to the man joining a labor union. But a labor union? That's totally bourgeois from the Leninist point of view. So do you want to get a few extra scraps in a system that's exploiting you? No, we want to overthrow the whole system, but the workers are not going to get to that point on their own. They need to be nudged, they need to be pushed, they need to be educated, they need to be propagandized. And who's going to do that? The vanguard of the proletariat, that's who. Intellectuals who can devote themselves full-time to the agitation and education of the working class. So, in other words, the working class will not automatically bring about communism. You need to give history a push, Lenin says. This is not in Marx, but it is in Lenin. Secondly, Marx's view was that communism comes about once capitalism reaches its most mature phase, most fully developed phase, then its status as a fetter on the productive forces is at its most obvious. You've got a very heavily industrialized society. But in the case of Lenin, he's looking at a Russia that is not super developed. Maybe 2% of the population was industrial workers at the time of the Bolshevik takeover. So much for Marx's idea that the overwhelming majority of people will be workers at the time of the revolution. Lenin did not think that was strictly necessary. He could push through a communist revolution even when the industrial proletariat, which is supposed to be the revolutionary class, is a very tiny minority. So that's what we see in his work, What Is to Be Done. That's why he thinks it's absolutely fine to push forward with the revolution in 1917, even though the conditions do not seem to be ripe according to classical Marxist doctrine. In the October Revolution, the Bolsheviks, Lenin's party, simply take over the major power centers in society. And it's astonishing how easily they do this. By this point, the provisional government had lost a lot of support. They had lost the support of the army. They had lost the support, if they ever had it, of the countryside. The war, World War I, was by this point becoming increasingly unpopular. And Lenin was able to capitalize on all this. The Bolsheviks made all kinds of promises they had no intention whatsoever of keeping. We're going to provide self-rule for all the nationalities. Nationalism is a totally backward bourgeois 19th century notion, according to the Bolsheviks. They couldn't care less about any of this, but they made that promise. They said they would withdraw from the war, which indeed they did. They did keep that promise. Another thing that they exploited was the fact that the provisional government that had taken power earlier that year, provisional government had gone around promising elections to a constituent assembly. But they kept postponing the elections. They kept just promising the elections. You never got a hard and fast date for the elections. And Lenin, we see it in his April theses that he wrote in 1917 and on other occasions as well, says, well, look, the reason that they're not giving you a date is because they have no intention of holding those elections. If you want the Constituent Assembly to actually come into existence and have elections held, then you've got to support the Bolsheviks. Well, they do come into power. They do hold the elections to the Constituent Assembly, and the Bolsheviks win 24% of the vote. So at that point, the next day, they allow the Constituent Assembly to meet for one day. Then goons show up and close it down. And actually, there is a peaceful demonstration in favor of the Constituent Assembly that winds up getting fired upon. Several people are dead, and that's the end of it. But by this point, the Russians were completely exhausted. What they wanted above all was peace. So the Constituent Assembly died a fairly unmourned death. Now, let me read to you a little passage from Richard Pipes, a great historian of the Russian Revolution. I mean, listen to this. This is why I love reading Richard Pipes. He says, "Viewing the Bolsheviks' power seizure from the perspective of history, one can only marvel at their audacity. None of the leading Bolsheviks had experience in administering anything, and yet they were about to assume responsibility for governing the world's largest country. Nor, lacking business experience, did they shy from promptly nationalizing and hence assuming responsibility for managing the world's fifth largest economy. They saw in the overwhelming majority of Russia's citizens, the bourgeoisie and the landowners as a matter of principle, and most of the peasantry and intelligentsia as a matter of fact, class enemies of the industrial workers whom they claimed to represent. These workers constituted a small proportion of Russia's population, at best 1 or 2%, and of this minority only a minuscule number followed the Bolsheviks. On the eve of the November coup, only 5.3% of industrial workers belonged to the Bolshevik Party. This meant that the new regime had no alternative but to turn into a dictatorship not of the proletariat, but over the proletariat and all the other classes. The dictatorship, which in time evolved into a totalitarian regime, was thus necessitated by the very nature of the Bolshevik takeover. As long as they wanted to stay in power, the communists had to rule despotically and violently. They could never afford to relax their authority. This principle held true of every communist regime that followed." Lenin described dictatorship, including the period of the dictatorship of the proletariat that Marx had talked about, as, quote, "power that is limited by nothing, by no laws, that is restrained by absolutely no rules, that rests directly on coercion." In the spring of 1918, the Bolsheviks did very poorly in elections to the workers' councils known as Soviets. They were defeated by other revolutionary parties, the Mensheviks, who were also communists, and social revolutionaries, who placed most of their hopes in the peasantry. So how did the Bolsheviks respond to this? Well, first by disqualifying these groups from running in elections in the future, or by just repeatedly holding elections until they get the majorities that they want. Lenin does keep another promise. He withdraws Russia from World War I at tremendous territorial expense. The Germans get a very, very favorable treaty, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, in early 1918. Of course, they're going to have to give away all these gains at the end of World War I later that year and in the peace discussions in 1919. But in the short run, it's a tremendous gain for Germany. Lenin's view is, right now, I just have to consolidate power, and we'll think about territory later. Paul Johnson, one historian I like very much, points out that theory kept on failing Lenin and the communists. They believed that their view was scientific, that Marxism was scientific, the whole apparatus was scientific, so they couldn't admit error. Why, this is science. They can't admit that they could have been wrong about anything. One thing that Marx had said was that the state has no interests of its own. The state is just the instrument that the dominant class uses to lord it over the other social classes. Now, according to Marxism, socialism was supposed to be more efficient than capitalism. It was supposed to produce more and work better. Well, they tried it. They tried what's called war communism. It's not really war communism, it's just communism. They called it war communism after the fact, when it was obviously a catastrophic failure. And so after the fact, they said, well, this was war communism. Sometimes during wartime, there was, after all, a Russian civil war. Sometimes during wartime, well, you know, you have to do some things that aren't so pleasant and that may not be so efficient, but that are necessary for the war effort. So they tried to make it seem like this was all just because of the war effort. But Trotsky, who was a close associate of Lenin, was more honest when he said that, no, actually, these principles that are being called war communism were aimed at helping Russia toward, quote, realizing genuine communism. So you can forget the term war communism. It was just communism. It was the nationalization of the means of production and transport. This is as summarized by Pipes. the liquidation of private commerce through the nationalization of retail and wholesale trade, and its replacement by a government-controlled distribution system, the abolition of money as a unit of exchange and accounting in favor of state-regulated barter, and the imposition on the entire economy of a single plan. Those are some of the principles of so-called war communism. Well, how did it turn out? Well, the factories were hopelessly mismanaged, but what other outcome could we have expected? These were people who knew nothing about running factories. There was an underground economy that developed. I mean, when the state is going to replace retail and wholesale trade with a government-controlled distribution system, you can imagine how that worked out. The result was a massive black market economy that was bigger than the official economy. They tried to get rid of money by inflating the money so badly that it couldn't be used. So between 1917 and 1923, hyperinflation raises prices by 100 million times. Large-scale industrial production falls to 18% in 1920 of what it had been in 1913. Coal output down to 27%, and iron down to 2.4%. Then in 1921, the number of employed industrial workers is now less than half the level where it had been in 1918. Now, remember the argument that capitalism amounts to fetters on the productive forces because the productive forces can't be fully utilized under capitalism? Well, how about this? Under communism, you got the number of employed industrial workers falling by half. The standard of living falls by two-thirds. Workers lose the right to elect union officials and to strike. Now, how could that be, right? You would think that in the workers' paradise, of course they'd have these rights, but the argument was, well, precisely because this is the workers' paradise, you don't need to strike. Why would you need to strike? What would you have to strike against? You'd be striking against yourself. Why, this is you. This regime is you. You are the government. Why would you strike against yourself? One communist observer called the whole thing a disaster, quote, unparalleled in the history of mankind. Lenin did not respond to this by saying maybe we have to rethink some ideas. He responded with the firing squad. Shoot, exterminate, these are very common words coming from Lenin and his various memos. Meanwhile, they've got the problem that food production has dropped. The provisional government had been making requisition demands of the peasants and not paying them very much. The peasants were fighting back, and the Bolsheviks hated the peasants. They thought they were stupid and backward and superstitious. They had never really managed to get a foothold in the countryside, the Bolsheviks, and now they wanted to. They were going to assert themselves in the countryside. They were going to go there and grab food for the cities, grab food for the Red Army. They send armed detachments to the countryside, and they tell peasants to snitch on their rich neighbors. If your rich neighbor is hoarding food, has too much food, you tell us. Well, if there's one thing that makes all the peasants unite together, it's being told to snitch on each other, or it's having their so-called excess food taken away from them. So, first of all, they start planting less. Duh, what do you expect? They're going to plant less so that they'll have less of a so-called surplus that can be taken from them by the Bolsheviks. So there are massive peasant rebellions. Meanwhile, there are food shortages in the cities. You got strikes there. So the real civil war, you know, there was a civil war in Russia. It was between the Reds, the communists, and the Whites. These are people who basically wanted to restore the provisional government. They're incorrectly thought of as people who wanted to restore the Tsar. That's not true. The army officers among the Whites did have monarchist sympathies, but that was not what the Civil War was about. But the real Civil War was actually fought between the Reds and the Greens, the communists and the peasants. And in fact, my own professor at Harvard for 20th century Russia was Vladimir Brovkin, who had lived in the Soviet Union. He was one of the Soviet Jews who was allowed to emigrate in the agreement reached in 1974, and he was extremely anti-Bolshevik. He had a very interesting book called The Mensheviks After October on what happened to these other Marxists. But he specifically said the real civil war was against the Greens. Lenin used poison gas in this civil war. Eventually, he's got to retreat, and we'll get to that a little bit later. We've got the Red Terror that pretty much breaks out right from the start of the regime. They've got to terrorize the population. so that nobody feels safe, that people just feel resigned to their fate. It has to be just crazy in order to keep people just so utterly demoralized that they wouldn't even consider trying to threaten the regime. So they execute Tsar Nicholas II and his whole family. And the official reason for this is that counter-revolutionary forces might rally to the Tsar in trying to overthrow us, but you could keep him under house arrest, you could do all kinds of things. The real reason was spelled out by Trotsky, who said that the decision to execute the entire family, the husband, wife, the children, was not only expedient but necessary. The severity of this punishment showed everyone that we would continue to fight mercilessly, stopping at nothing. The execution of the Tsar's family was needed not only to frighten, horrify, and instill a sense of hopelessness in the enemy, but also to shake up our own ranks, to demonstrate that there was no retreating, that ahead lay either total victory or total doom. Well, how about that? December 1917, the Cheka, the Soviet secret police, is established, and this later becomes the NKVD and then becomes what we know of as the KGB. It's true that the Tsar of Russia had had a secret police force, but the communist secret police force was 16 times as large. Also, a major plank of the Red Terror was the complete revamping of law in Russia. Richard Pipe says Soviet Russia was the first state in history to outlaw law. What does he mean by that? Well, instead of having fixed norms and fixed rules by which to evaluate conduct and to decide legality and criminality, that was all swept aside. We don't need that anymore. That's all bourgeois backwardness. We need judges who will rule according to a revolutionary conscience. Whatever they think will advance the revolution is how they should rule. So that kind of arbitrary rule is what replaced the rule of law in Russia. So no formal education was necessary to become a judge in communist Russia. All you needed was basic literacy. According to Lenin, the task of the communist judiciary was to provide, quote, a justification of terror. The court is not to eliminate terror, but to substantiate it and legitimize it. Already within a few years, there were 70,000 class enemies languishing in concentration camps. But the situation was so chaotic and pathetic that in 1921, Lenin announced the new economic policy. He called this two steps forward, one step back. We have to take one step back and regroup, but it's okay because we've taken two steps forward with the revolution. We have to make a strategic retreat by now, for now. So no more grabbing of food by government goons. The peasants would pay a tax in kind, and then they'd be able to sell in the open market. A limited amount of private business was once again allowed to operate. So there is a very, very limited reintroduction of some market forces here, but too late to prevent a horrifying famine. Over 5 million lives were lost. It was triggered by a drought, but there are droughts in Western countries all the time. You don't have a famine killing 5 million people. Cultural and spiritual life are very interesting. I don't want to go too much longer, but let me read for you a little passage describing what music became like in some quarters, that even music needed to reflect proletarian values. We don't need wind and string instruments, so here's the passage. The instruments were not winds and strings, but motors, turbines, and sirens. So in other words, sort of things that workers would use. We'll make music with this, because we're all about workers. And an officially designated noisemaster replaced the conductor. Symphonies of factory whistles performed in Moscow produced such bizarre sounds that the audiences could not recognize even familiar tunes. The new genre had its greatest triumph in the presentation in Baku in 1922, on the fifth anniversary of the October Revolution, of a concert performed by units of the Caspian Fleet, foghorns, factory sirens, two batteries of artillery, machine guns, and airplanes. In terms of the church, of course, the regime was officially atheist, so they went right after the Russian Orthodox Church, also the Russian Catholic Church, but that was very, very small. In both cases, they demanded that the churches hand over their valuables to be melted down and sold, allegedly for famine relief. And Lenin did this on purpose so that people would say, ah, look at the terrible churches conspiring against the people who are starving. They won't turn over their valuables. Of course, Lenin is not, I mean, hello, he's not going to use that money for famine relief. The United States wound up intervening with famine relief with Herbert Hoover as a food administrator. But instead, they wind up using the money to buy weapons from Germany later on. So what wound up happening was that there were many clergymen who tried to block entrance to the churches. I know in the case of the Russian Catholic Church, the Pope, Benedict XV, said that he would pay the regime an amount of money equivalent to the value of the valuables so that they would not have to be melted down. These are considered to be sacred objects. And Lenin turned this down because he wanted to humiliate the churches, and getting a check from the Vatican isn't going to serve that purpose. You had religious instruction outlawed. Churches were closed, not all of them, but some. And some of them were converted to secular use. I can think of an example of church that was deliberately razed, and then in its place, they put public bathrooms, not a very subtle thing. Well, Lenin dies in 1923, and of course, that's when things get more interesting still, because there's no provision for his replacement. There's a lot of jockeying for position, and of course, we all know Joseph Stalin will wind up victorious there. Well, I'm going to leave it here. That was a really, really fast overview of this material, but isn't that interesting stuff? I love this stuff. So fascinating, so perverse and crazy. You can't help but be interested in it. This is from my Western Civilization from 1493 course, which is currently available at ronpaulhomeschool.com through that program. If you want to get just this course a la carte, it will pretty soon be available at my a la carte site, tomwoodshomeschool.com. And the first people to get that course will be my gold and platinum people who support the show at supportinglisteners.com. So you'll have an opportunity to learn all kinds of things from world history that you feel like you should know, and I try to keep them animated and interesting, and you can learn them on the go. So keep that in mind. That's one of the big benefits of supporting the show over at supportinglisteners.com. All right, I hope you enjoyed this really frantic episode on Lenin and the Russian Revolution, and we'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.